Time for the weekly update. Malcolm Honlein is with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Fridays at this time, to review the news of the week. We call it the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good to be with you, as always.
Have you been briefed by your friends and colleagues in Australia about the fire that was set to in an attempt to destroy a synagogue? We saw pictures and videos, look pretty devastating, frankly. And obviously, there's a bigger question about how the Australian authorities are handling this. Any update regarding that situation?
Well, yes, I have been in touch with people there, and it is a terrible, clearly vicious anti-Semitic assault. This comes on the heels of reports of the number of anti-Semitic attacks in Australia skyrocketing over the last year and having increased steadily. And the this was an attack where they threw accelerants into the shul, set fire to it. There was one or two people who were injured, but they burnt tefillin. They did extensive damage to the shul itself. So the government has condemned it. People, in fact, overnight, the prime minister and others spoke about it, against it. But the, it's a representative of a deteriorating situation there.
Yeah, tenuous situations in many cities around the world. We've got to be on our guard. By the way, do you make anything of this story? I don't know if you've heard anything other than what we've heard, that the criminal who shot at a Jewish person in Chicago was actually found dead in his jail cell. Did you hear
anything? Yes, he committed suicide. Yes, he was the guy. Unfortunately, didn't face charges, and I don't know what information I got to find out if he had been in contact with others. We'll have to wait for a report from the Chicago police about any interrogations that took place. But he did supposedly committed suicide. That's what the report is.
Yeah, while in prison. All right, let's go to one of the most important stories of the week, unfortunately, and that's, of course, the fate of Omer Neutra and the fact that, again, an American Israeli Jewish family, deservedly so, of course, got worldwide attention, unfortunately, for a terrible reason, because it was determined that their son was killed on the October the 7th in a heroic fashion, of course, as all these soldiers that day and so many other days have met their fate in that manner. So now this it continues to highlight and put the spotlight on a potential hostage deal. There are still hostages that are believed to be alive, a good number of them, most likely. And you saw, and no doubt reacted, I don't know if you spoke or sent a message to him personally, but you saw what President-elect President Trump, and in this case, again, President-elect Trump, what he said about hell to pay if the hostages are not released by the time he gets into office next month. I know we discussed it last week, but in light of the Omer Neutra terrible news, in light of the statement by President Trump, do you feel that there's now greater hope that Hamas is ready to go to the negotiating table?
So far, we have no evidence of it, except for their own needs. They have no incentive yet to negotiate or to release the hostages. Israel has put a new plan on the table. It was communicated to Hamas. Qatar has once again joined, playing a role in the negotiations. The response from Hamas, a leader, was to say that they threatened to massacre all of the hostages that happened during the night. And I think the president's comments, as I said last week, were very important. And you see that the impact of the pre-presidency has already, in so many instances and places where countries are reassessing their positions, their stands, in view of the anticipated but undefined challenges that they might face. So the message has to be very clear. This has been tolerated for far too long, and I and I'm sure everyone appreciates your constant reminders, and every shul should be saying tehillim for it and for them and for our soldiers who are still in harm's way, regardless of any ceasefires in the north. Israel is acting in Lebanon. Israel is acting in Syria. Israel has to carry the burden for everyone else, and still does. That so the situation in Gaza remains very tense. Israel took out another terrorist cell and eliminated a number of weapon depots and storage facilities as they hunt down terrorists. We have to see what means are possible. Israel and others want to get a respite, most of all, in order to get back all of the hostages, and that means both living and those who unfortunately were killed.
Even though he's made statements before and has certainly created an atmosphere that you just described and spoke to us about last week, but still this week's comment, this week's statement by President Trump was an actual direct threat to Hamas. And that was, I thought that was jarring. And I'm wondering if they, as, the party of the other part, I wonder if they, if it's going to make them reconsider any of this. Because the impression has been, as you just described again, they have no desire or need to really make a deal. Something's different than last November, a year ago, when they felt the need to make a deal. You could explain to us what's happened over the last year, but obviously they're much more comfortable with the situation than they were then. So we, as those who are concerned about the hostages, wonder if this direct threat from President Trump is going to be a game changer or not. I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying, they still have no need or desire to adjust accordingly. But could it be? Could it be that such a direct statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has a profound impact. And, part of the leverage in situations like this is unpredictability. When President Bush II, when we were on the border of Iran, when we had 150,000 troops, we had the maximum leverage. We could have toppled and we could have entered. We could have forced them into concessions. And the same thing is true in numerous circumstances, including now, because they know that President-elect Trump tends to act on what he says. This was not a prepared text. This was his personal comments. Right. And I think it has a profound impact. They have to be sitting there reassessing, but they don't care about what happens to the people in Gaza. There is a profound difference. The infrastructure of Hamas was destroyed. They are continuing to mop up. They're continuing to kill. They still have the ability to shoot missiles. They still have, troops left because they started with 30,000. If you eliminated 20,000, it still leaves 10,000, and they're supposedly trying to recruit new people, young people now, both from within Gaza and from outside. They are going to take advantage of any ceasefire. Israel anticipates that and is also looking to the future and see what lessons they learned from October 7th, especially as we learned that 3,000 troops were massed on the planning an attack along the Lebanon border to replicate October 7th in the north, that Israel has to learn a lot of lessons. It has to have a much better early warning. All of those things are true. But I think the president's warning is very powerful statement.
And again, the difference, we touched on this last week, it just seems like Hezbollah politically, I'm not talking about, out of sympathy, but politically has to care about the Lebanese people. And as you just described, Hamas couldn't care less about the people in Gaza. And that's a consideration in all of this.
They never cared about right. them. They used them as kind of fodder.
But that's the difference.
Human shields.
But that's the difference. The Hezbollah has to care, right? Politically, they have to care about the future of Lebanese people, how the Lebanese people view them as infiltrators in the Lebanese system.
Yeah, but when you have such a weak government, when you have Hezbollah essentially the government and operating at will, it's true the people of Lebanon have turned against. And if you listen to some of the interviews of the media, which is looking for criticism of Israel and to tell all these horror tales, and which they repeat nightly and daily, BBC, NPR, all of these guys, it's just there isn't a single broadcast where they don't find something to try to slam Israel with. But when you listen to the people in Lebanon, and I do speak to people there, I mean Muslims and Christians who live in Lebanon, but most of all, when I listen to the interviews, very few of them attack Israel, criticize Israel. They criticize Hezbollah. They talk about their circumstances and even going back to their homes, and they try to make this very dramatic, that their homes are destroyed. Let them go to the north of Israel and see how many homes were destroyed And people, but they're not. They're angry at Hezbollah. Hezbollah recognizes it. So to that degree, I think what you're saying is right.
Yeah, and it's much more common. It's much more common to find support for Israel among them than among the people in Gaza. Even with
There's a history of it. And you have first of all, you have a big Christian population. You have other populations there, but. I'm not saying that they're the fan club of and we go back to the days of the good fence between Israel and Lebanon, but I do think that if the Lebanese government is reasserted and it's free of Hezbollah, if that were possible, it's not. They're recruiting, as I said, and they're bringing weapons. We know that even yesterday Israel hit a transfer of weapons. They're trying to bring weapons out of Syria and take advantage of the deteriorated situation there. To get to arms depots, a lot of weapons fell into the hands of the terrorists there, and those who are celebrating what's happening there better think twice, because nobody knows what the day after. And leaving it in the hands of ISIS and Al Qaeda inheritors is not a positive outlook.
All right, and
whatever.
I was going to say we're going to get to that in just a moment. I just want to. In terms of, I don't even know if it's fair to ask you to comment because it's so disturbing, but I'm assuming you saw the videos and pictures that came out of the tunnels where the hostages are being held.
Yeah, I have a hard time looking at it, but yes.
The condition, I mean, why wouldn't we expect the conditions not to be that way? But when you see it, it's like, when you see it, you say to yourself, you want to do everything in your power to influence whoever needs to be influenced to get them out.
Absolutely. And when you listen to the accounts where people do say that some of the people were held in cages, and you think about this is going on for more than a year. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's impossible to consider what these poor people have suffered. It makes it imperative that we pray, that we act, that we speak out, that we support the families of the hostages and keep the pressure on, and we need to see America match those words with deeds to put the pressure. Qatar now, as I said, is back somewhat playing a role, and there is a proposal on the table. We'll see what will happen, but it's, again, ceasefire. It's not, these are not peace negotiations, nor was it in Lebanon. This is for ceasefire, and they will try to take advantage of it to regroup. Israel has to continue operating. We have to make sure that they can't. And as we see already, they're moving into the south, and we see in Gaza as well. They're terrorists. They don't care what will happen to the people afterwards.
Yeah. If we think that they have anything close to our values, we don't realize how wrong we are. All right. So now in Syria, and I'm sure I speak for many when I say this. I'm only familiar with what I know in the Middle East because it's been part of my life for many, many decades. The situation in Syria has not. And that's why that I, as the common man, is trying to understand, along with many others, what's happening. Now, one person boiled it down as follows, that this is essentially a Sunni Shia civil war, and the rebels are representing the side that's against Assad in this case, and this is what it boils down to. And now Russia and other countries are either already or need to decide what side they're on. Is it as simple as that? That it is a religious civil war?
No. In a word, no. And it is indeed very complex. People have to look at each of the sides and understand who's fighting who. We've had statements by commanders of the rebel forces in Aleppo saying in interviews to I-24 News, Israeli news, we're fighting a common enemy. And they salute Israel and the United States and even make reference to President-elect Trump's statements and the statement saying that, look, we have a common enemy in Iran, and they want to neutralize at most Israel, but they would love to have Israel on their side. Israel, Assad also reached out to Israel, and they said, if you get rid of Iran from Syria, we will help. And it's in Israel's interest to secure the borders, to make sure that the flow of weapons you know, doesn't end up both going to Hezbollah and going to terrorists who are along the border with Israel. And the sides are not at all clear. Iran and Russia and Turkey are all operating. They're going to have a meeting in Qatar, I think, in the next day or so, as part of the guarantors of the Astana peace process in Syria. And they are going to be meeting, but Turkey sides with the opposition, and the Russia is obviously, and Iran are siding with Assad, whose army has changed its name, but doesn't seem to be able to change much of its function. And they've been running, and now we'll start to have to build defensive lines around Damascus. Aleppo fell, and Hama, and now Homs is under assault. And you have to look at the map to see how strategically important
it's in the interest of Russia and Iran to support Assad, because
first of all, Russia has invested so much there; they have a lot of equipment, some of which they moved out of the way. But you know, in Aleppo, for instance, the rebels took over an air force base, got airplanes, got a lot of sophisticated equipment that is stored. Syria has bought and gotten from its allies, Russia and Iran, huge amounts of weapons, some of which were being transferred to Hezbollah, but most of it for them to fight. Their army clearly has been running from the battle fronts, and maybe to consolidate. They were clearly unprepared. So Russia has a big air force base and a naval base in Latakia. They always look for warm water ports. This is a historical a goal and aspiration, and they have it in Syria. But also, this is their footprint. This is their foremost footprint in the Middle East. For Iran, this is ideological. Iran is a fulcrum of the seven-country assault on Israel, and for the network that they created. Syria is a front line for the shipment of weapons, and certainly is incredibly important in terms of Iran's desires to control into Iraq and the flow of weapons to the region. It would be a humiliating defeat for all of them. And we don't know what will follow. So far, there's no democratic force that looks like it will take control. And, you know, we often don't think about the day after, and that includes in Iran and includes in other circumstances. And you always have to plan that before to know what you want to have come out of this. And to a degree, Assad at least kept control, and Israel could pressure with these terrorists. We know that they have no limits, and they certainly don't care about the Syrian people. So the you look at the three parties, one of the goals, we hope, is that Turkey, Iran, and Russia will just go after each other. Right. And that would solve a lot of people's problems. But they are not coalescing as yet, but they have their interests. They could easily divide up the country, which would be a terrible thing also for Israel, for the security region. The Kurds would pay a heavy price because Turkey will then move, as they are doing every day, bombing them, attacking them, but would move to annihilate them. And Russia would then just consolidate its position. Its weapons, it can't ship many weapons because everything is tied up in Ukraine. They have sent some stuff, but it's perhaps not as much as what would have been the case if they weren't involved there. So each of the parties has their own burdens. Turkey on its borders, and Iran, Russia in Ukraine, and there, and it's an extended line. But we still do see weapons movement and attempts to bring it across the border, and Israel striking, and they hit last night a site along the border of Lebanon and Syria to prevent the transfer of weapons.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, the beloved NSN app. Support our fundraiser, please, fjbunity.org. Malcolm Honlein with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. So aside from Israel's role in doing everything in its power to stop the flow of weapons, as you just described, is there a way to determine what's best for Israel in this scenario? you know, the old, is it good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? Is there a side that Israel should be paying more attention to or considering helping? Or, again, as you just described, let both sides just, you know, kill each other, so to speak, because in the end, we really don't know what's best for Israel when it comes to the future of Syria.
Well, chaos generally does not work in our order. You know, it's also the case when people talk about removing the government in Iran, for instance. You got to think about who's going to fill the void. And in many cases, as you know, we often get a worse situation, not a better situation. So there is no simple answer for me to give you on where Israel lies, because Israel itself doesn't know.
Right.
They have to do two things: protect their border on the Gaza, on the Golan, which, you know, we forget about. But Iran has long tried to position its militias along that border. Could they heat up the border as a distraction, as a unifying thing? Absolutely. And as you know, they have not removed the presence. And then, of course, the Lebanon-Syria border, but also that this not become then, you see, an influx of weapons through a deteriorated Syria. I mean, Syria did try to control some of it, even though ineffectively, it seems, to because of their own interests, and they know that this is a threat to him. I know from my discussion with Assad several years ago what he really thinks of this Iranians, and he certainly doesn't want his fate in the hands of Iran. He does feel more comfortable with Russia and thinking they don't have a specific agenda. He doesn't have the view of Turkey wanting to control the region as Erdogan wants to, or Iran that's trying to take over and export its ideology and dictate to these countries. But the good options are very limited.
What difference would it have made if Trump was already president? Do you think it would have been a different couple of last weeks in Syria?
I mean, it's very hard to speculate about a thing like this, but I think that a lot of things have to be reassessed. The question of the arms supplies to Israel, would the war have been different if there weren't all the no's? Would Israel have been able to prosecute more effectively? Would pressure the Qataris and others, you know, we're offering Syria certain exemptions from sanctions in return for their behavior and what they do. I think sometimes you got to double down in order to get the message home, right, and then hold out the carrot. But first you got to have the stick. And we know from the history of the Middle East, the people are no longer buying Hamas and Hezbollah. Their standing in the region is certainly deteriorated. And when you ask leaders in the region, they all stand. They want Israel to do a massive job and finish doing what they didn't do. And you see Hezbollah has disassociated itself from the war in Gaza, and now even withdrawing a little bit from the border with Israel, they claim a victory. But the Arabs see the reality on the ground. On one hand, they're showing all the death and destruction, and then the other hand, they're claiming that they want a war. So I think that a lot of this creation of imaginary victories is backfiring for them, and the interviews show it.
When people in the last 48 hours ask you if the ceasefire is holding up north, what's your answer?
In the breach. And to a degree, yes, but Israel continues to respond to attacks, and it's accused of violating the ceasefire, but they're responding to violations when they see weapons being moved down south and when terrorists are trying to establish. And, you know, Israel has not had the time, and I know people get impatient and say, why does it take so long? If you understood the topography, if you understood the challenges of all these underground facilities with this church that they went into, and by chance, and did not know that what was underground. They knew that it was an operating base because they had pictures. They saw the terrorists going in and out. But when they opened it up and they find inside a tunnel packed with weapons, some advanced weapons, it took truckloads of weapons out of places like this, and this one in particular. So Israel still has a big job to try to do it, and we hope that the people will try to force the Hezbollah guys out, but they have no weapons. They have no real ability to stand against against them. And the Hezbollah dress up as civilians and go back and try to reestablish their presence there, which is why Israel must respond and must have the ability to continue to respond.
When the Houthis shot at central Israel this week, was that simply their way of saying they're not participating in the ceasefire?
That's certainly one of the messages. And remember, they're one of the forefronts of the Iranian octopus's assault. And so far, with remarkable impunity, despite the strikes by Israel and by the United States, British planes against their facilities, it is unbelievable that they still have this capacity and the chutzpah there. But it's not just firing at Israel. They're firing it at Western ships still in the Red Sea. This should be totally intolerable, and they have to annihilate their resources to do this. And the this is not fighting Iran, it's indirectly, but the Houthis should have been destroyed a long time ago.
And if there was someone else in the White House, might it be viewed more intolerably?
I don't, and it's not just the White House. It's, where are the Europeans and everybody else who's paying so much more for goods because of this? They seem to tolerate it. In fact, assaults on their ships, including American ships, these are causes belli, I think. This is a threat of a declaration of war when they attack an American ship, and including our military ships, or fire at them, that the response should have been immediately much stronger and should be today much stronger. So the Houthis continuing to fire, I think, is symbolic. Remember, it is one of the seven fronts. The internal situation in Yemen is a disaster, and yet they continue to function as if nothing happened.
On the topic of the ceasefire, so yesterday we got a little bit of an insight in terms of what's happening up north because Yonatan Lifshitz from Tzfat was here, and we also heard that the Kiryat Shmona Yeshiva reopened. Are you getting reports about the north filling up again and real movement up there, or this is just isolated episodes?
I think both things are true. There are signs of life and people moving back, finding the immense destruction. And I have to compliment Mr. Bloomberg, who gave $27 million yesterday to rebuild in the north. And others who will give the amounts of money that will be needed are astronomical because of the destruction and the businesses that were all destroyed. You don't think about a chicken coop, but when thousands of chickens were killed, you can't just go back and rebuild it. It takes 3 years for the vineyards to come back, to be regrown, and the needs are going to be immense. But yes, there are signs of life. People are going back, some not staying there. They're going there to rebuild, or their families continue to live elsewhere. But God willing, if they have a sense of confidence, they are very disappointed that there isn't a buffer zone along the Lebanon border.
Right.
They've made that public. And Israel may yet have to create that. It is trying to do so. They eliminated a lot of the forests and the dense brush so that, they have much more visibility about what happens along the Lebanon border.
And what happened yesterday when I asked Mr. Bloomberg to come on the air to talk about his contribution up north? He answered, no, but good to hear from you.
he was asking if you were matching it.
Maybe that would be the only way I can get him on. Could you explain to us, what's going on in South Korea? And I know that this doesn't, you might say that everything affects Israel. I know it doesn't exactly affect some of the things that we discuss here. But again, it's one of those situations where we're just not as familiar with what's happening. And it looked like the government either did or was about to be toppled relatively quickly. Could you explain that situation?
It's probably inexplicable, but the president, sensing some sort of a threat, initiated martial law, brought tanks and moved tanks towards the capital, suspended the government without any authorization, caught everybody off guard. The head of the army resigned, saying that, for his role in this, it's caused immense reaction in the country. And obviously they rescinded the executive order and the troops and everything. It's not clear exactly what which threat he was responding to, but he won't step down. And so there are a lot of calls for election or for his removal. It's very important because South Korea is a key ally and has good relations with Israel in many areas. And destabilizing another place and having to have resources applied is, you know, a distraction that's really unnecessary. We'll see whether he can, the president can survive. I would doubt it, because the reaction and the shock of the people was quite remarkable, and they took to the streets right away to demonstrate against it. So I'm sure we'll learn more about what motivated this action, but it certainly did not sit well with anybody and was rescinded within hours.
Does Israel have foreign workers from South Korea? I don't know if that's a thing or not.
I don't think they have foreign workers from South Korea. First of all, South Korea's economy is pretty strong, and so people, you know, it's not like to bring people from Thailand and other places where they don't have jobs, and I guess the offers would be less attractive. There are business exchanges between Israel and South Korea that are extensive.
If the schedule is accurate that we were briefed about regarding Prime Minister Netanyahu's trial, he's going to be spending a lot of time in court during a time of war. And I'm wondering, I mean, we know that you're friendly with him, et cetera, so you may think one way for that reason. But I'm just wondering what you think that now at such a sensitive time in Israel, the leader is going to really be, again, if the schedule's right, I don't know if it is, that we heard, is really going to be preoccupied with the legal stuff.
And he's tried to challenge it repeatedly. I think that it's not to pervert the process of justice. Justice should be meted out. Nobody's above the law. Nobody should be beyond the law. I think many would argue that some of the cases that are being brought, like we've seen here and elsewhere around the world, have certainly questionable bases, and that it's an assault, and that they're trying to use the judiciary to achieve political ends. But I certainly think that distracting the prime minister at a time when Israel is facing such critical challenges is certainly a very questionable decision.
Yeah, I mean, and there are times in the last year that I think might have been, you know, even better. But now it really looks like we're entering a very, very sensitive period of negotiation with the enemy, changes in the United States, obviously, and all these other changes that we were discussing, Syria, South Korea, etc. It just seems like a really strange time for all this to occupy his time. But then again, as you said.
And do you want to see all of this stuff regarding the failures from October 7th? Is this the time now to bring it out? I think there has to be an investigation. I think there has to be responsibility. I think all of those things are legitimate, but you got to think about when is the time to do it. When do you, all of the bitterness, and to have a former top military and political figure talk about ethnic cleansing and make these outrageous statements, right, which are so damaging, and become fodder for the enemy.
That was just awful.
I used to respect a great deal.
Yeah, I mean, it just. I don't know. Sometimes, look, you and I have discussed it a million times how the disregard that some Israeli leaders have for public statements, the way that they don't value how public statements are going to be viewed. You want to say something privately or have a personal opinion that, you know, could be productive in a certain setting, that's fine. But they just don't understand the value and the sensitivity when it comes to these public statements. By the way, how long ago did you... I mean, again, a political scientist like yourself, I'm assuming months ago you said to yourself, the president will certainly pardon his son. I assume this was no surprise to you.
No, I anticipated that. I mean, there are various scenarios. If Harris had won,
right,
maybe she would have done the pardon, or he could even have stepped down a week early and she could have done it.
Right.
And I think given the circumstances, and I think you're going to see many more pardons. He has a lot of other members of his family who are facing charges. I think he's already, you know, paid the price, and I think you can anticipate more pardons coming before the end of his term.
Life is funny, huh?
Yeah, sometimes.
thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again.
Good Shabbos.
Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, Friday's weekly update here at JM in the air. Even when I am suffering from this cough, we still get the weekly update on the air. Thank God. Bliein hara, bliein hara.